What happens when a quiet, bookish girl with a love for building grows up to command thousands of troops in combat zones and still battles imposter syndrome behind the scenes? Meet Dr. Jen Donahue, a retired Navy captain, civil engineer, and self-described wild thing from Texas A&M, who broke barriers as one of the few women in the military's elite Civil Engineer Corps. From building bridges in Iraq to leading battalions in Afghanistan, Jen's story is one of grit, growth, and discovering that true leadership isn't about proving your worth. It's about creating greatness in others. In this episode, she opens up about what it means to be the only in the room, how to lead with empathy instead of ego, and why embracing who you are rather than trying to fit in is the ultimate act of bravery. Come join us in Jen's journey. Welcome to Dog Tag Diaries. I'm your host, Captain Kim. Our podcast is where military women speak their truths and share the stories that have shaped their lives. From moments of resilience to hard-won triumphs, we hold nothing back. 2024 was a year of incredible milestones for this community. Our voices were heard in over 33 countries around the world, and we ranked in Apple Podcasts' top 200 in personal journeys in the United States, a testament to the power of authentic storytelling. Now, as we launch season 4, we invite you to journey with us once again. This is more than a podcast. This is a movement. Let's break barriers, shatter silence, and amplify the voices of military women everywhere. Thank you for listening, sharing, and making this possible. This is Dog Tag Diaries. Today's guest is a powerhouse of quiet strength, fierce determination, and undeniable skill. Dr. Jen Donahue is a retired United States Navy captain and former regimental commodore who's led engineering teams from 4 to 1,800 across some of the world's most dangerous terrain, from the deserts of Afghanistan to the battlefields of Iraq. A PhD engineer and founder of her own firm, Jen has designed earthquake-resilient structures around the globe, taught at top universities, and now speaks internationally on leadership and mindset. But what makes her truly remarkable isn't just what she's built, it's who she's become. In a world where she was often the only woman in the room, Jen learned that the real measure of leadership isn't about proving your own greatness, it's about lifting others up. Today, she's here to talk about her journey, her battles with imposter syndrome, and how to lead with empathy, courage, and authenticity. This is Dr. Jen Donahue. Thank you so much for being on Dog Tag Diaries.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Oh my gosh. And we always start our interviews off with who and how you were as a younger version of you, like this little girl, Jen. And we do this so the listeners have a better understanding of how you just transformed that little you into who you are today. So let's hear it.
I have always been a builder. Like, you know, other little girls, they'd like to play with maybe Barbies or something like that. I had Legos and Lincoln Logs and Erector sets and all of these other things that I've always, always loved building. In fact, when I was 8 years old, I actually got a Barbie dream house. But the Barbie dream house wasn't for Barbie, it was for me, so that I could build it over and over and over again, and I could cut it up and I could rearrange it. And that's how I was as a little kid. And I love math. I love science. I am a nerd. I'll just admit it right now. But that's who I was as a little girl.
Did your parents encourage all of that?
My parents didn't know what to do with me. My whole family, they're artists. And they do all of this amazing work. And I'm really the only person in my whole family that knows how to do math. I'm also the only person who knows how to read a map. So anytime, you know, starting at the age of 5 years old, my parents would just like hand me a map and, you know, say, hey, get us to Wyoming. And I navigate from Texas to Wyoming as like a 5-year-old. So I don't think my parents quite knew what was going on.
Oh my gosh, that totally must have come in handy with land navigation. And when they gave you the map and the compass and gave you those grid points.
Oh yeah, I love land nav. Man, I am a master at land nav, especially night land nav. Oh yeah, that's like my jam. That was like, people were like, I don't want to go in land nav. And I'm like, hell yeah, let's go.
Oh my gosh, you and I are going to go do a mission together here in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, perfect.
So how did you discover the military?
There was really no military in my family for quite some time. You know, obviously, grandfather went and fought in World War II. I had an uncle and my stepfather were both drafted for Vietnam. But other than that, there was really no military. And whenever I got to college, I was an ocean engineer. And I started to look at my friends and they wanted to go down to Houston and get jobs for these big corporations. And I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, that sounds boring. I need to go see the world. I want to get out. I want to explore. And a friend of mine said, hey, have you thought about maybe joining the Navy? Because the Navy has a civil engineer corps where they send you all over the world and you build. And I thought, okay, that's perfect. And it was. I am so glad that I went in that direction because my first duty station was in Guam. I mean, imagine going from West Texas to Guam. I mean, that's quite a change.
Yeah. Okay. So you started your career in what college?
I went to Texas A&M.
Okay. And then what attracted you to the ocean part?
I think it's because I grew up in the desert and I was like, I just want something with water. And I love to swim and I love to dive. And I looked at regular civil engineering where you just build buildings and everything's static. And I was like, that's kind of boring. And I thought, I want something that's more dynamic. And, you know, I just kind of went and took a bunch of classes and found out about ocean engineering, which was all about basically building, but in an ocean environment where there's all types of wave action and currents. And so all of these other things that you had to think about whenever you're building, as opposed to just building a building that just stands there. And so that to me was really exciting.
Yeah. So that was probably very attractive for the Navy to want to bring you on.
It was. Unfortunately, I never got to practice ocean engineering. They threw me straight into civil engineering, which was fine, which was absolutely fine. But I still love the pieces of ocean engineering that I could still bring to the fight.
Yeah. Did you ever get to practice that later on?
Not so much on the ocean engineering side, but then I went back to school and got a PhD in geotechnical engineering. And that's all about engineering for earthquakes and understanding the ground and the ground movement. So whenever I went to Iraq, we were going out to all these little bases and I found that I could really use my geotechnical background there because of the way that the silt had so much clay in it that they were just dumping water and all of a sudden an oasis would pop up and nobody could figure out like why would they pour water on the ground? Why it doesn't just seep in? It was because there was a bunch of clay. And so all of a sudden you had an oasis and then you had bugs and mosquitoes and all kinds of other issues. And so I was actually able to use some of my geotechnical background when I went to Iraq.
Oh my gosh. See, I see the little girl, that curiosity of you as a little girl coming out of there as you were talking about like, oh my gosh, why is this happening? Why are the bugs there? Why is this oasis coming up? And oh my gosh. Okay. I have so many questions, but let's go back to where did you go to OCS?
I went to OCS in Pensacola, Florida. I had Gunnery Sergeant Ouellette in the United States Marine Corps. Which, as you know, that's one word. And I had such a great time. It really stretched me into understanding like what all I can do because I had never been through something that rigorous. And wow, I came out on the other end thinking like I might be invincible.
Yeah, true. Because you said growing up, most of your family was all artists. And artists really don't have that very uniformed, regimented schedule.
It's true.
Yeah, that must have been like a little bit of a culture shock.
I came home after OCS and my whole family still didn't quite know what to do with me because I sat up really straight, you know, whenever I was eating and just sort of my whole demeanor had changed. They really respected it. They're very supportive. But they were just like, we don't know what to do with you. And then my mom got all excited because a couple of months later, I found that I was going to Guam. And so she was all excited that she got to go and see me on Guam. But what's really interesting, though, is that my mom remarried and I got a stepbrother in this whole thing. And he saw how much fun I was having in the Navy. And he was like, oh, hell no, she can't go have all that much fun. So he stopped what he was doing. And then he joined the Navy. And he became a pilot. But since I was about 2 years old, well, 2 years senior to him, he was older, he would never, ever salute me because I was his sister. I'm like walking around as a Lieutenant JG and he's an ensign, you know, we're out and like all of his friends are saluting me and they're like, you're not going to salute her? And he's like, no, that's my sister.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not saluting my sister.
Well, that's so super cool though, that you were able to inspire him.
It was. And then I got my younger cousins also saw like all the stuff I was doing. They joined the Army, but I have two cousins that joined the Army. And so we are now a very military family.
Oh my God, look at the revolution you started.
I know.
And the theme that your family still doesn't know what to do with you.
They still don't. They just accept me for who I am. And you know, they need a math problem or whatever, they just give it to me. I also program all their electronics.
Oh my gosh, I'm having you over to my house too. So yeah, let's talk about your career in the Navy. So you went to OCS at Pensacola. And then after that, you said your first duty station was Guam.
Yes. In between, we have civil engineer course school. It was about maybe 3.5 months long, but they teach you everything you need to know about being a civil engineer corps officer. That's out in Port Hueneme, California, which is north of Los Angeles, south of Santa Barbara. So I was there, got to meet all the other civil engineers that were going through my year. It's about 50 of us. And they kind of threw us all over the world, but I got to go to Guam and I loved it. I'm a diver, I'm a runner, and there was this amazing group that was there and we were doing open ocean swims like every Saturday morning and we were all doing triathlons. I met a super handsome guy and later he became my husband. I mean, it was absolutely fabulous.
Oh my goodness. Yes, it sounds like you had a really positive experience.
I did. I got to learn a lot. I worked with a lot of civilians. I think the most fun part was that probably about 6 months after I'd gotten there, I was in charge of something like $36 million worth of contracts all over the base there. And I would call my friends back in Houston, you know, the ones that just went straight out and got, and they're like, man, we're still like getting coffee for people. They hadn't really done anything. You know, they were maybe doing a little bit of design work, but I'm managing $36 million worth of contracts. I mean, it's like, it's amazing what the military gives you. And you know, it's like, kind of like throw you into the deep end and you survive.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. That is one of the beautiful parts of being in the military versus civilian world. You really get hands-on training and more so than you would ever even imagine. And of course, they give you all these different titles, which is amazing too, because you get to learn a lot of different skills, which then you can all bring together.
And it's true. For a civil engineer corps officer, you could be a contracting officer. You could be a public works officer. You could go to the CBs, which is actually where I spent most of my career. But you have all of these different things. And so whenever you come out, you're light years ahead of anybody who is in your previous year in college. I mean, because you have so much responsibility. You are learning so much so quickly. You're gaining all these leadership skills also that they will never even had a chance at probably maybe 10 years from where you were.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It is such a beautiful part of the military. And then, well, we'll have to talk about that reintegrating back into society. But just so the viewers have an idea, because we're going to talk about how you were usually the only woman in the room. What years did you serve?
I started in 96 and I was able to retire in 2022.
Wow, you did your full 20, oh boy, Matt, 26?
Just right on 27.
Oh, okay.
I guess it was 2023. So yes, I'm like, how many years ago did I retire?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quickly.
Well, back then I have to say, I understand that error because I was in 1995. So really being the only woman in the room, let's talk about that.
So I guess I should amend my years. Technically, I did join in 1994. So the Civil Engineer Corps, they hire you while you're in college, which is really cool. So I was like an E3 while I was in college. So that's where the 27 years comes from, math. Okay, so being the only woman in the room, like, as you know, in 93, 94, that's when they first started women into combat roles. They could be pilots and they could also be in the construction battalions. I was only the third female officer in the battalion whenever I joined in 98. And honestly, they still didn't quite know what to do with us. You know, we go on these field training operations, and typically all of the male officers, they all have their tent, you know, and all of the enlisted males, they all have their tent. Well, there were so few females that they didn't know what to do with us, and they didn't want to put the officers in with the enlisted, but it was like me and the supply officer were the only two females, and they couldn't give us a whole GP medium. And so they didn't know what to do. I mean, it was just like the silly little things like that that you never really think about. And then they were thinking like, do you need your own porta potty? And it's like, no, we don't need our own porta potty. There was a lot of growing pains, you know, in the first couple of years that they had females in the battalion. But I would say right now, things are so good. Like, at least in the battalions, people aren't looking like male, female. It's like, we're all just the same. And I think that's something that we can really say. But you know, one of the first projects I had with the CBs is I went to Alaska and we were drilling and blasting. I was really the only woman there. The whole island, you know, we had some Marines, we had the Army, and then I had my group of CBs. And I think there was maybe three women out of about 400 people on the island. You know, so you do get to be the only. And sometimes that can be lonely, but sometimes it can be pretty fabulous.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, how did you feel in that environment?
I loved it. I've always been one of those people who's like, I don't necessarily want to be called out because I am a woman. I just want to be a CB. I just want to be an officer. I don't want to be a female officer. I don't want to be a female CB. I just want to be that person like everybody else. And wow, again, I just had so much fun. I think if you're trying to separate yourself out, people will separate you out. But if you want to say, hey, I just want to be like everybody else, a lot of times they will, and they won't segregate you and they won't treat you differently than anybody else. And so I think with that type of attitude is one of the things that really helped me, that, you know, they didn't just say, oh, well, you're over there, you're a female officer, we don't know what to do with you. They're like, oh, well, you're an officer, just go over there.
That's really amazing that you had that experience, because I know there was a lot of females who, especially earlier on, experience like the gender bias and sexual harassment, sexual assault, MST. So it's really wonderful to hear stories like this as well, where the company sounded like they were really accommodating. Like, hey, even though it was frustrating, I'm sure, to be like, no, I'm just a woman. Like, I don't need my own latrine. I don't need my own porta potty. But it was nice that they were trying to accommodate you and make you feel very comfortable in that environment.
And I would say probably 80% of the battalion was totally fine with us being there. There were about 20% that were not. And they were usually the older ones. And, you know, it had been a boys club all this time. And I'll just tell you, there was an ops chief that we had, and he was giving our supply officer a really, really hard time all the time. And I just finally had it. You know, so even though I'm a JD, I went into the ops and I just dressed him down, like in front of everybody. And I was like, you want to pick on her? You go through me from now on. And after that, it was cool. Like, he left her alone. Like, he was trying to get everybody to, like, you know, kind of go after the supply officer, like, not a good way. But after I just sort of went in and kind of laid down the law, you know what? Everything was okay.
I love that you supported that female officer, and it probably made her feel empowered as well.
And she stayed. You know, she was really thinking about, this isn't for me. You know, I could go to a ship and I'll be fine. But it was just so new to have females where we were that after that, she's like, you know what, this isn't so bad. I want to stay. And it was really nice to have her there. It was actually, I could bounce ideas off of, you know, there's other times when she's like, who else are you going to talk to about some of these things?
Yeah, it is really great. That female bond, that really healthy female bond, is like a beautiful thing. So like you said, only having a few out there, it was really nice that you were able to stand up to her, even though there may have been some like repercussions for you. But the fact that you stood up for her probably showed her that, oh gosh, yes, I can feel safe in her care. And that was just really like a really positive act to do. So I could see how you climbed the ranks pretty quickly then.
Yes, I have a mama bear complex. So I think that's part of it. And it doesn't matter if you're females, like if you're under my care, like I've got you. I think that's one of the things that did sort of set me apart, was like, I truly believe to succeed in the military, it's not about you. It's about taking care of your people. If you can take care of your people, you're going to succeed. But you have to turn it on them as opposed to just concentrating on yourself.
Yeah. So when did you realize that?
I realized that while I was in Alaska. And okay, so it wasn't all roses and rainbows and puppy dogs and all the things and unicorns. So I really, really messed up my very first job in the battalion. They made me the admin officer because they were missing an admin officer and they had to fill it. So they put an engineer as the admin officer. Like, that's the worst idea ever, just to start with. But I didn't know how to lead people at that time. Like, I had led civilians and they were pretty easy to get along with. But then I looked at all of my bosses. All of my bosses were yellers. And so I thought in order to properly lead troops, you had to yell at them. And so I tried that a couple times. And that was not me. I mean, there were days I would come home and it was hard. You know, I had to think about, am I even going to make it in the Navy? If I had to like just yell at people to make them do what I want them to do. And whenever I got to Alaska, I had a really, really great chief. And he basically pulled me aside and he's like, I don't know what you're doing, but this isn't you. And whatever you're doing is not working. You need to figure out how to be yourself. And once I was given that opportunity to say, oh, I can just be myself. Oh man, everything started to click after that. It really did. And that's where I figured out, it's like, hey, if I stop trying to be the big bad officer and look at me and you do what I tell you to, and just realize, oh, I can actually be myself and talk to people and have conversations and then start to draw them in and get them excited about it and like have their ideas, you know, brought to the forefront. And oh my gosh, now everybody's starting to click. Everybody's starting to get excited. And it's like, oh, this is how you're supposed to lead. You know, you're supposed to be your authentic self. You're supposed to take care of your people. That's where I figured it out. But I had to have that chief basically pull me aside.
You know, you said something so important right there, because we just follow when we're young or we're put in unfamiliar environments, we kind of mimic what the higher up is doing, what the lead staff is doing. And so whether it's healthy or unhealthy, I think we know deep down, like you said, you have like that innate feeling. You're like, ooh, intuitively, this isn't me. And so thank goodness, because there's not a lot of people who have that chief to bring them aside and be like, hey, just be you and let me help you develop that you, because we still don't really understand what that you is yet because we're so young and the environment's new.
Yeah, you've never done this before, you know, so you don't have anything to really fall back on. So you just, like you said, you just look to see what are your bosses doing. I guess it works for them.
And that has developed you into what you do now, which is, well, you started out as an inspirational speaker. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And grew this business of you now where like you have your own business, you go around the world and speak. Like that is a huge accomplishment. I mean, I know you, like you said, you're like this little girl still that is very unique and has her own unique gifts. But like when I read your bio and looked at your website, I was like, this is one of the most amazing, creative, intelligent, capable women. And I couldn't wait to speak to you. So yeah, let's talk about how you transformed or how you transitioned from the military and then decided to make this global empire.
I hadn't really thought about that, that I, I'm like the emperor now or the empress.
You are. You're the empress.
You know, after COVID and we were coming out of COVID and I was looking to retire, I was wondering, it's like, how do I still give back? There's something that I just, man, I love working with the troops because I could see them grow. I could help them be better than whenever they started. I could get them the right training. I could mentor them, all of these things. And then I was retiring and it's like, I have to have something. And I decided, you know what? Maybe I should start speaking. And a really good friend of mine, she's a very, very prominent speaker in the United States. I think she's the most booked woman like in the US. And she said, hey, have you ever thought about telling your story? And I said, no. It's like, I didn't even think about it. It was like, no. Then all of a sudden that little seed started to take root. And I thought, you know, I could help people this way. And that's what I started to do. And I went out and started to talk to people. I've now started a coaching business. I just finished a book and I'm going around the world. I'm giving workshops. I'm giving keynotes. And there is nothing more satisfying than having somebody come up to me afterwards and say, thank you. Thank you. Like I have been trying to figure this out. And it's like, and then it clicked. And so thank you. And it's like, yes, I have like done my job today, that I am helping others. That's what it's all about, man. I was put on this world to help as many people as I can. And that is what I'm going to do.
I love that you found your gift. You tapped into it. You had that support system and you went out and got it. And I saw about the imposter syndrome, which I am so proud of you for being so vulnerable to talk about, because Dakota and I, who are the creators of our nonprofit Reveling Retreat Project and Dog Tag Diaries, went through a women veteran entrepreneur class, and they actually had a full hour discussion on imposter syndrome. And thank goodness, because all of us that were in the program felt it. So let's talk about the first time you got on stage, your first speaking event. What did you feel like?
I was excited, actually. The way that I looked at it is like the people that were in the audience, they actually wanted to hear from me, as opposed to whenever I would have to go and stand out at the battalion at 6:30 in the morning, because nobody wanted to listen to me at 6:30 in the morning. But at least whenever I was on stage speaking, then I was like, oh, okay. Really, the imposter syndrome started to kick in a little bit later when I started to see the other speakers that were going to be there. And I looked at how popular they were and how many books they've written. And I would start to think, what do I have to give? You know, and all of a sudden, all of that imposter syndrome starts coming in. It's like, well, I'm not that popular. Nobody knows me. Would anybody even listen to me up there? And that's really imposter syndrome. And then I have to like basically take a deep breath and think about all of the stuff that I've done in my life and realize, wait a minute, I have a mission. And that mission is to help other people. And I have a message that can also help them as well. And so I would start to think about, stop making it be about me and make it be about the audience. And whenever I flipped that around and said, no, I stop thinking about yourself, start thinking about how you can help other people. Okay, I could like take a deep breath and realize, okay, this is going to be all right. But whenever you start to think about yourself and compare yourself to others, oh man, you can get into that imposter syndrome spiral and it is hard to get out.
Yeah, there's a transformational moment, exactly what you just said. That is so interesting because I feel like when we are born, we have like this very open, alive spirit, and no fault of anyone because they all have their own stories, but we're told maybe to bring it down a little bit, or maybe you shouldn't do that. And I just remember because as a little girl, I had this really big personality. I wanted to be an actress and a singer and do all these things. And just because of my upbringing, it was a different, like, no, you go to college and you get married and you have kids. And so when I would go out for auditions, people would be like, well, who do you think you are? Michelle Pfeiffer? And I was like, well, I mean, she started from somewhere too, you know, like she was just a little girl with a dream as well. So yeah, I kind of do. But after a while, like people saying, telling you, giving you negative feedback, it does give you imposter syndrome. You're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be like so positive and thinking that every audition I go to, I'm going to get or something like that. I, much like you along the way, realized like, no, this is my gift. Like I want to be able to give people those take my breath away type feelings on the movie screen and like be able to provide that. Like, and now I transitioned into something else. However, I totally understand how you could have had that imposter syndrome, especially going to all these events, like you said, and speakers that you saw that you were like, oh my gosh, but they were in your position at one time too, getting up on stage for the first time and probably saying the same thing.
Right. Most of the time we get imposter syndrome when we're trying something that's outside our comfort zone. We're trying something new. We're stretching our boundaries. A lot of times if we're not growing, if we're not doing anything, we don't have imposter syndrome because we're not trying something new. We're just sitting and not doing anything. It's when we really start to say, hey, you know what? I want to try something. I want to do something new. That's when I've found that I have this mean little voice in the back of my head that's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You should just stop. Everybody's going to figure out you're a fraud anyway. So I get that mean little voice in the back of my head. I don't know if you have one, but like that starts to really chime in anytime I think about something new.
Yeah, no, I like that message because you are correct. Dakota and I talk about this a lot too. Just starting this nonprofit and the podcast. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do all this? Are people going to even like me? Or am I doing this correctly? Like you said, when you transition out of that and you're like, wait a second, this is about getting military women's stories out there and helping other military women and then bringing together this community, that imposter syndrome goes away. So I do love that message that you have.
I also like to attribute it to the fact that we have to hear that mean little voice, but also what I've been writing about and what I speak about is we have this like inner warrior also. And that's the one that says, hey, knock it off, and basically tramples that mean little voice. You know, that's the one that says, hey, you know what, you can. Because we all have that inside of us also, but we listen to that mean little voice as opposed to listening to our inner warrior that says, you can do this. You know you can. You've done it before. Maybe it's not this exactly, but maybe you've done something similar and you've succeeded and you're going to be helping people. And so what I try to help people with is like figuring out who that inner warrior is and trying to strengthen that so that you can make that transition and say, hey, it's not about me. You know, it's about the people in the audience.
So is this all part of your book?
Yes, it's part of my book, and it's also part of my keynote and my workshops.
And what is your book called?
Becoming the Warrior.
And it's already out?
It'll be out in March of 2026.
Oh my God. Okay, so you're going to be doing a book launch next year.
I am.
Okay, so we'll have to have you back on right before your book launch.
Okay.
Yeah, we can talk more about it.
No, that would be fantastic. I'm really excited about this. I've had several people go through and read it already, and they're like, oh, wow, this is really helping. So I'm pretty excited about that because I've already had all of the readers kind of go through, and, you know, it's another way to help people.
Well, we have a question that we usually end the interview with, and that is, because you give such beautiful, powerful advice, what advice would you give a woman in the military or thinking of going in the military or is post-military, is a veteran?
Can I give two?
Yes, you can give as many as you'd like.
Okay. I would say, first off, find a mentor. And that is so important. If you can't find one, find two. You know, there's a lot of times maybe one mentor might have one portion of your life and another mentor might have another portion. I mean, I have five. Just because, you know, I'm an overachiever, but they will help you. They can't hear your inner monologue or anything else. They know what's truth and they can help you. So go find a mentor. And then I would say the second thing that if I could give advice to anybody is just be yourself. If you are your true, authentic self, you know, things are going to work out. Might be a little rocky at the very beginning, but that's how I've succeeded in everything that I've done is I've just been my true, authentic, genuine self. And I'm happy. I'm not feeling like I'm somebody else when you're frustrated and all of that. And it's just be yourself.
I love that powerful advice because you're right. Being your most authentic self is so beautiful. And there is a journey to getting there, to learning all that. And there's different stages, like you said. So to have those different mentors, can we hear about your mentors?
Absolutely. One of mine is technical, because I still do a lot of technical work. So he is all about helping me be on the cutting edge of a lot of different engineering projects. I have another one that's all about business and running businesses and how to be profitable and things you need to take care of. I have another one that's all about leadership. I was a former admiral that I greatly respect. And then I have another one that's about work-life balance, which I probably need to call because I've been falling down on that a lot lately. So it's just something probably I need to work on more than anything. And then I just sort of have like a general mentor, like, you know, hey, I need to ask you some random questions that might not fit into some of the other categories, you know, because each one of these are so different, you know, the technical as opposed to work-life as opposed to leadership. And so that's why I found that if I have a mentor for different aspects of my life, I feel a little bit more whole.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm curious what you said about work-life balance. What does that look like for you?
Oh, I need to work on it. I like to work. I really do. And if I could work a 60-hour, 70-hour week, I would actually probably be happy. But I have a family. I have a husband. I have two ginormous dogs and a cat. And I need to make sure that it's like, okay, even though I like to do what I do, I love them also, and I need to make sure that I'm being respectful and spending time with all of them as well as friends and family. And it's something that I have to remind myself of. I am a recovering workaholic. And I have to remind myself, it's like, no, you know what? I can save this until tomorrow.
Ooh, I love that you're able to do that. You're right, because it's not even really work for you because you found your passion. So when you're passionate about something, of course you want to continue. I know you're passionate about your husband and your two dogs and your cat and friends and family too, but you're right. You really can get, I mean, you could be like, oh yeah, I'm only going to do 3 hours of this today. 6 hours goes by because you're so passionate and involved. You don't even realize it.
Oh, I can be working and my husband tells me that, you know, it's time for dinner and I don't even hear him, you know, because I'm so involved in what I'm doing. You know, it's so, yes, it is something that I have to be very mindful of.
Yeah. So what are some of the things you do to remind yourself or take yourself out of that work environment?
I like to write lists of everything that I need to do for the day. I know that you can't really see it because we're on a podcast, but just to kind of give you an idea, it looks something like this. You know, there's like all kinds of little boxes and things I need to do. And this is what I do almost at the start of every week. And it's like, this is what I have to do. But then I start to look and I have little timers that go off that say, hey, do you really need to work anymore today? You know, it's 5 o'clock or whatever it is. And take a look at the sheet and all of the different things I have to do and who requires what on what days and getting it all organized and say, hey, you know what? I'm drawing the long line right here. We'll get to the rest tomorrow. Nobody's going to die. Everybody's going to be okay if I turn this in tomorrow. I think one of the things about the military is it also gives you a really good perspective. Nobody is shooting at you today, hopefully. Nobody is shooting at you today. Nobody's trying to kill you today. If you don't get it done, you're not going to get shot. Do it tomorrow. It'll be okay.
I was just going to comment on that, Jen. You're right, because the military, you are in a very high demand fight or flight. I have to be on my toes so no one dies type mentality. So it's really hard to transition out of that to be like, oh yeah, just like you said, no one's going to die today. Well, hopefully no one's going to die today. I don't need to be in that mindset anymore. And I feel that's just a conditioned response from being in the military.
I think it is. And I used to get so upset with coworkers because they would just get crazy about if there was different fonts on a PowerPoint and there's like the world was ending. And I'm like, you know, this really isn't that big of a deal, guys. Like, nobody is going to kill you. Like, if you have Times New Roman as opposed to Calibri, like, it's going to be okay. Like, we don't have to go to that type of extreme about worrying about the fonts on the PowerPoint. We can just get it done. We don't have to freak out. Stop freaking out. So I think that's a definite thing that the military has given us is our freakout meter is different than everybody else.
Yeah, we definitely have to relearn that in order to reintegrate. Yeah. And be accepted into the civilian sector. Yes. Oh, well, Dr. Jen, it has been so amazing talking with you and just learning about like how you were so different as a little girl and how that transformed you into this beautiful, intelligent, wonderful woman that you are today. Just the global empress. We just nicknamed you, and we will definitely have you on for your book launch in 2026.
Oh, thank you. And you know what? This has been just such a really fun interview. And also, I want to say thank you to you. It is so important what you are doing for all of your listeners and giving them hope and giving them ideas and helping them keep going, helping them transform themselves. So I want to say thank you for all that you do.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for giving me positive feedback. This is like woman power. Thank you very much. And I love that we have connected because like I get curious. I truly get curious when people connect to see why we connected and what we can create together. So we will have coffee in Bend. We will figure out our favorite coffee places and we'll meet up soon.
I would love that. Absolutely.
Thank you again, Dr. Jen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Dog Tag Diaries, where military women speak their truth and share their true stories. Every story told here is a step towards understanding, healing, and connection. Share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. And remember, your voice matters. Together, we're building a community that empowers, uplifts, and inspires. Stay connected with us, follow Dog Tag Diaries, leave a review, and let's continue to amplify the voices of women warriors around the world. Your voice matters. Share your thoughts and reviews to help us grow, improve, and continue making an impact. Until next time, stay strong, stay true, and keep sharing your story.